So tonight we move on to why is mindfulness? Why is mindfulness just as part of the Eightfold Path? Now mindfulness is something that you can finally feel like I know what this is, right? This is what we practice, attending to our breath, our bodies, emotions, thoughts, this very familiar quality of mindfulness. Now it's interesting to notice that we're going to spend a whole 12 months exploring the Four Noble Truths, and just 1 month on this quality of mindfulness. And so it kind of speaks to a little bit of a bias in how this tradition has evolved in the West, that we tend to focus just on the meditative practices without this much bigger understanding of how it fits in to the Buddha's overall teachings. So just to reflect on that, that this one thing of mindfulness has such a big emphasis, yet it's just one piece of this much bigger teaching. It really orients us to the practice of liberation, that why do we actually practice? You know, we often come to practice maybe to help relax our anxious mind, to find some way of working with chronic pain, to have a little bit quieter of a mind itself, to have more of a sense of accessibility to ourselves and other people, maybe to meet some of our inner turmoil and have that quiet down. But as we practice for a while, we start to see that it actually points to a much deeper way. And part of the issue is that this technique of mindfulness inherently starts to deconstruct the sense of who we are. It starts to deconstruct the sense of self. The sense of self is very much tied in to the root causes of our suffering. You know, thinking back to the Four Noble Truths, there's origination of dukkha, of suffering. There's the reason for that origination is because of the formation of self. That sense of tanha, that hunger to be, the hunger to not be. And understanding that whole mechanism is a way of understanding how we create this unnecessary suffering in our lives. You know, it doesn't mean like there's a magic wand that you no longer have any aches or pains. You won't feel emotional pain. You won't feel the impact of other people's way of how they hold you in a certain way. The prejudices, the judgments, all the isms of our world won't magically go away. But that added on resistance, that does fall away if we start to really understand this sense of self as a conditioned phenomenon, something that arises based on the conditions and then passes away. We have this sense that, okay, I'm always constantly going from one, like this streamline, connect the dots of selves. If we look closely, we see it arises and it passes away. It's conditioned. It's added on. So mindfulness, especially in terms of the Eightfold Path, the wise mindfulness, starts to really deconstruct the sense of self, of the assumptions of how we take ourselves to be, the solid body, the solidness of our reactivity, of the content of our mind, our sense of mind content, and even the dharmas itself. These are all places that we place identity in. And in the sutta, the Buddha goes through and starts to deconstruct each one of those. So the sutta I'm mentioning is called the Satipatthana Sutta. Satipatthana Sutta. Often translated as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. Some people prefer the Establishments of Mindfulness. And it's, if you're going to read one sutta, read this one. Because you're going to relate to your meditative practices. You start to see the context of why you meditate and how to meditate. Maybe some more clear understandings of that. Now the Satipatthana Sutta is found in the middle-length discourses of the Majjhima Nikaya. These are the different bundles of the original early teachings of the Buddha. As far as we can tell, you know, they've been really, you know, altered and kind of massaged over the years. So who knows how much it is close to actually what the Buddha said and how much it was kind of put together in different bundles. But this sutta is such a key one to understand as insight practitioners, as mindfulness practitioners. Because this one really is the main sutta that develops our meditative practices. Now there's four aspects to it. And we're going to tackle that this month. There's the aspect of the body, there's an aspect of Vedana, which is this feeling tone, the quality of things being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. If you look closely, you see every moment's experience has that gentle flavor. From that point of flavoring, then we start to amp it up into wanting more of it, wanting less of it. There's also the suit, or the foundation of mind states, you know, the content of our mind. And then finally, this foundation of the dharmas themselves. Things like the hindrances, things like the Four Noble Truths, the awakening factors. So there's quite a lot in this sutta. There's quite a lot. Rodney spent a whole year looking at it. Joseph spent 2 years looking at it. I'm going to spend 1 month. So I hope you're quick studies on this. So we will go through it in a much more, in some ways a lighter way, but also a more directed way. You know, I'll be talking from my own understanding of how the sutta points directly toward awakening and how that is kind of embedded in the sutta and not get so lost in the details. So this month I'll offer 2 talks, one tonight, focusing on the first foundation of the body. This is really the bulk of the sutta. And then the second talk will do the last 3 foundations. And then by then, everybody should be awakened. So the sutta begins by saying this is the direct path. This is the direct path to awakening. And when you hear that, that should kind of catch your attention a little bit. It's not like the meandering path or the indirect path, or if you do this, something will happen eventually. It's like he clearly says this is the direct path. That practicing in this way, there's a lot of nuances of how to refine how we practice. That leads to the most progress, the most deepening of our practice. So the body section. So if you look at it, there's body, there's Vedana, there's mind states, and Dharma states. So the body part is where he starts. You know, and that's often where we start instructions. Because we need to find some place of ground. We need to have some way to orient to this present moment, as opposed to being lost in the elaboration of thought, of concept, that we spend so much of our time. I always like to quote James Joyce in Dubliners when he says Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body. You know, we often go through life like that with a little bit of, you know, we have a lot of interesting ideas, or sometimes very gripping worries and obsessive thoughts, but we're not quite connected to where our bodies are. So this foundation of the body has many different practices. I think it has around 30 different practices in terms of you take each piece of that. So again, we're going to have a much lighter brushstroke, but seeing really the essence of that brushstroke. So keeping this overall arching intention in this exploration, it's the direct method toward liberation, toward waking up. And we can boil that down even more to understanding this formation of the sense of self. The more the self is believed in, the more it's present, the more suffering we will have. The less it's believed in, the less suffering. When it falls away, then there's a level of freedom and peace that is no longer tied to the circumstances of life in the same way. You know, certainly the Buddha, if you look at the suttas, he experienced pain, he experienced irritation. I mean, sometimes he's like cursing out people. You know, sometimes he has to go to bed because his back's hurting. You know, he had dysentery and he had all these different issues. But you know, when his beloved disciples died, he experienced grief. So not to idolize this sense of what liberation means, that you will never feel anything again. You're still human. You're still going to feel this. But there's a level of perspective that is fundamentally changed through the practice. So first, the sense of arriving into the body. Into the sense of this physical body. It's very grounding. It helps to orient where we are in space, in time. And we begin by cultivating this steady attention, this steady, sustained attention on just this body, just on this breath. You know, feeling this breath, feeling this body sensations. So steady attention, sustained attention. Of course, you know, the mind isn't used to that. The mind's conditioned to be distracted, to get lost in thought. So there's a tremendous amount of patience that has to come, to willingness to start over again and again. So in the sutta, the Buddha begins with breathing, the first essence of connecting with the breath. Of course, the breath is nice because it's always accessible, it's always present. And for many people, it's something that's it's a neutral place of attention. Not always so. Sometimes people connect with their breath and it brings up levels of worry and anxiety. And when that happens, it's good to switch focuses. Focus on something else that's more accessible, that's more friendly to the mindfulness, to settle in, to develop its stability. You know, we have to learn to eventually meet all experiences, but starting off is very helpful to focus on something that allows the mindfulness to relax, to actually land. So the sutta begins kind of in a very almost boring way. You know that you're breathing in. Know that you're breathing out. Having the discernment to actually know that. Now, when we're lost in thought, we don't know that where the breath is. Have you ever done the noting practice, you know, breathing in and breathing out? And sometimes you can get really lost in thought and you're saying in when you're actually breathing out and vice versa. And you kind of wake up and try to realign your noting with the actual experience. Now the sutta quickly starts to move though beyond just that sense of steady attention to notice that, okay, if you're breathing in long, notice that. When you're breathing in short, notice that. So there's this pointing to this capacity of seeing without judgment, seeing without preference. Now this is actually the first step toward this disillusion of self. Because if you look at the language of self, the footprints of self, it's around control, it's around judgment, it's around criticism, it's around this is the good pile and this is the bad pile of experience, externally or internally. Right? When that arises, the sense of self is operating. Now please understand, the sense of self has a lot of utility. You know, it's not like we lose that capacity, we just prioritize it. We reframe it in a different way. So we actually have the ability to be discerning in a much clearer way, but we're not bound by that, the way that we're bound when the sense of self is seen as a true reality. So breathing in long, breathing in short, the sense of knowing that, and starting to develop this really continuous focus, this sustained attention. Now, those of you who've meditated, you know, for a long time, or you know, you're on a retreat or something, you know that at first it's really tenuous how to make that contact to sustain it. And if you practice for a while, sometimes it stabilizes, so the attention is able to just to rest on the breath, very almost effortlessly. There's also the sense of not controlling our breath. Not only not judging it, but also not controlling it. Not trying to make it be one way or another, but to actually see how it actually is. So starting in a very simple, very neutral capacity, learning a skill set, then we can start to apply to much more complex personal aspects of experience. You know, when we have that reactive thought, that thought of judgment that arises, can that be also seen by this capacity of mindfulness? Starting with the breath, just noticing the breath this way is that way. Letting go of this sense of control. Then the Buddha starts to go into that even more subtly, to just feeling the breath, to starting to feel the whole body in a sensitive way with the breath. Breathing in the whole capacity of all, you know, feeling all the limbs, all the trunk, all the head, everything is starting to be felt. So we're starting to go beyond the narrow confines of just the breath to feeling the whole sense of the body. Again, with a quality of not judgment, of not trying to control it, but simply notice what is present. Now, in doing so, we start to loosen up this idea of breath and body as two separate things, and just start to see this open, this almost landscape or a sea of changing experience, the changing nature of the breath moving through the body. And in doing that, we start to say, well, what's solid here? What's so solid that when I think of my body, I say, okay, here's my body, this is what it feels like. But when I go internally to feeling what the breath feels like, that starts to become a little shaky. It starts to feel less defined. Okay, what's happening is that sense of body, the idea of body, the sense of my body, is starting to soften as you go into the actual experience of the body breathing. The next instruction is that we'll breathe in, calming the bodily fabrication. Calming the body fabrication. So this can be a nice intentionality as we're breathing in and breathing out to calm this sense of reactivity, this sense of fear, of anxiety, of worry, of the hindrances. Because when those things arise, naturally we tend to get reactive around it. We tend to get more tight, more amped up. But to intentionally breathe that out, to relax, to calm the system with each breath in and out. And you're also starting to calm the sense of identification. That's a essential fabrication, is a sense of this is my body. And including all the concepts around it, that this part I like, this part I dislike, this part I'm proud of, this part I'm ashamed of. You know, the societal messages of how your body fits in or doesn't fit in. All that starts to calm down. See, what we're doing is we're taking off these layers of thought, these layers of belief, these layers of concept. And that taking off, we're discovering a much more essential aspect of this moment's experience. Now there's a refrain that happens again and again in the sutta, and I'll share part of that. And she remains independent, unsustained by anything in the world. And this is how a person remains focused on the body in and of itself. So just to take a moment to unpack that. So independent. You know, so often we kind of gauge how we are in the world based on other people, based on our history, how we were brought up, how our parents taught us about our bodies, how society teaches about our bodies. And so we start to let go of that preconception, that pre-idea of how we should be. It's starting to become more independent, actually meeting how the moment actually is. Unsustained. You know, part of the independence is also the sense of reactivity that we have. You know, how we judge ourselves, how we're judged by others. The unsustained by anything in the world. Now this piece is, we have to look at that a little closer. When they say world, it's not about like literally being that sense of food and sense of nourishment. It's more of a sense of the kind of the mental phenomenon of how we create the world. This is a subtle thing because it's so close to our eyes, so close to the very way we perceive. We have a perception and we think that's accurate. You know, we see in the perception there's an accuracy to that. But that perception is actually really created by our history, by our culture. I like to use this example of that bridge in France. It was one of the biggest bridges in the world at the time, one of the tallest, I believe, and the French looked at it and said, oh, it's, you know, it's massive and powerful, and the Germans looked at it and said it's elegant and graceful. Same exact steel, same exact concrete, why such a difference in perception? It's because in German, bridge is feminine, in French, it's masculine. So that very basic conditioning of when you're a little kid, you're taught, you know, this is the feminine, this is the masculine, that shapes how you actually see life. That example carries through almost every aspect of our lives. You know, think of one thing that's not there. I mean, the way we view ourselves, the way we view the other, you know, what we value, what we don't value, all that is added on. You know, there's a certain, we agree on it, so there's a certain functionality to it, but it's also part of our prison. And if you've ever been on the receiving end of that, when someone projects who you are based on your, you know, your skin color, your gender, your orientation, your religion, you know, and how oppressive that is. How oppressive that is. How we do that to ourselves. And I spend much of my time trying to help people see outside of the prison that's self-inflicted. How I'm not worthy, I'm not capable, I'm no good. That's just seeing that as a thought, that self-induced prison. So unsustained by anything in the world, anything in the world of our preconceptions, our ideas, our reactivity. So you get a sense that this refrain that we're sitting, meditating, we're relating to experience without this overlay. All the different strata, all the different textures of that overlay. So this kind of focused attention, you know, it seems like, okay, I can maybe do that when I'm sitting in meditation and everything is perfect. I'm comfortable, you know, my body's not hurting, there's no distractions. So there's a sense of, you may have a sense that it's this kind of a fragile state of mind, state of meditation. We need all the conditions to be just lined up. Actually, the Buddha points someplace else for this. You know, can we meditate with the distractions of the train going by? Can we meditate actually while we're in life? You know? So we often think at the end of a meditation retreat, we cultivate this nice steadiness, this sensitivity, and there's often a question, how do I do this when I go home? How do I maintain this steadiness of attention? And it's impossible. Unless you happen to have someone who's going to cook for you and you have no other responsibilities other than meditating. And you can have, you know, a teacher kind of help giving you some guidance. And that would be a very limited life. Right? So the Buddha actually points to something different in my interpretation of this sutta. It's beyond that rarefied state that's cultivated through sustained practice into a very transformed state of consciousness. A transformed way of perceiving life. We talk about insight practice. This is an insight that changes our very perception, our very way of seeing the world, the very assumptions we take as being me and other. Because it's very hard to keep that steadiness of attention in a, because it's usually willfully done. It's like, I am meditating. I'm paying attention to this breath. I'm not paying attention to my thought. And we have to start there, most of us. But if the practice works in this directed way, with this understanding of deconstructing yourself, at some point something shifts, and that ground that we took as being solid, that, okay, here I am going through life, that's no so solid. So actually, instead of being at a place of disconcertion, being disconcerted and being worried by that, you actually see this is a place of deep peace. Deep safety. In fact, it's the only safe place that you can find. So shifting from the sense of me paying attention, me cultivating the steadiness of attention, to this deep transformation. So in the sutta, you look at it, and he doesn't say just stay sitting down. He says, have the same quality when you're standing, when you're walking, when you're laying down, in whatever position you find your body. And goes on beyond that. So you're starting to shift from the very way you're perceiving. So whatever posture you're in, and then furthermore, when going forward and returning, when you're going, looking that way, looking this way, when you're eating, drinking, chewing, savoring, urinating, defecating, when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and remaining silent. To bring this all the way through. So we can think, okay, on retreat I can try to do this, but it's me doing it. But the whole point is not that you do it anymore, that you actually transform the very way that you, the place that you're seeing. You see through the illusion of separation. And then that seeing through that illusion, then it just naturally blends out to all activity, all interactions. So from this point in the sutta, it starts to get a little more serious. And we start to deconstruct this assumption of body in more and more, in some ways drastic, more clear ways. In the sense of deconstruction, there's a common approach you see in the suttas, that we take something as a whole, and what the Buddha does is take it apart, break it into its different components, to show that the whole is something that's been kind of manufactured, this idea of one whole thing. Right? And then we take that as being the whole thing, but if we deconstruct it, say, okay, this piece and this piece and this piece, we separate them out, there's no whole. And really the glue that brings those together, you know, of course there's the physical laws that are true, but really the glue that brings it together is our concept, our idea, our belief. We can see that, you know, when I say, okay, are you here? You say, ah, here I am. This is where I am. I'm feeling this. We point to our body as the point of reference. This is who I am. Now this, who am I, this is the key question. And this first foundation looks at the assumptions of I-ness, me-ness, mine-ness in the body. In the body. Your hand, your heart, your head. So often in this sutta it starts with an analogy. There's lots of beautiful analogies throughout the sutta. And one is of a sack of grain with different types of grain in it. And if you look at the grain, you can say, okay, that's a corn, and that's a wheat, and that's, you know, rice, and here's chickpea. You know, those kind of different discerning qualities. And so the Buddha says, now look at your own body and see how there's these different components. There's certainly the external pieces, and there's all the internal qualities. This section actually is often called the foulness of the body. And in terms of, we, you know, sometimes get kind of enamored that, you know, it looked pretty good in the sense of liking how our bodies look. So he starts to look at, you know, how, look at the hairs of the body, look at the sense of the fluids, like the pus and the mucus and the urine and all those different qualities. And as you do that, you see that maybe that, you know, I don't really want to identify with that part. That's me. I don't want that to be my who I am. But yet that's, you know, this is who the body is. Looking at the different organs, the liver and the spleen and the heart and the lungs. And so you start to deconstruct this totality of body into its parts. You start to take the parts apart. And what makes all these parts a whole? You know, other than, of course, the interconnection of the body, the functional whole, but the mental component, since the idea, this is the realm of the mind, the mind of the concepts, is really the idea of body, the idea of my body. That's what makes it whole. And particularly that sense of my body. And so starting to release the idea of body is the whole point of this sutta and this practice. So we start to connect, when we release the idea of body, what's left is this changing nature of experience. Have you noticed that, you know, this sense that you can sit down and say, okay, this is what my body looks like. This is my idea of the body, including all the self-judgment, the shame, maybe the parts you're proud of. When you close your eyes and actually go into the internal sense of the body, it's much more nuanced, much more rich. You know, often beginning students are a little disconcerted because if they do that, they see that sense of outline of body, it's kind of falling away, that sense of bodiness. And what's happening is the idea of body is starting to go into the background, and the foreground is the actual experience of the body. What's happening is we're starting to enter into the flow of the body, not this, the hardness of the thought or idea. So this deconstruction process continues even further as the sutta goes along, to start to go beyond the parts like a knee or a liver or something like that, to go into more of the elemental nature of the body. Now the elements, this is something that's a little new in our culture, in our society. But back in the time of the Buddha, it was very common to look at the four elements of fire, of air, of earth, and of wind. And these four elements are, you can look at each physical thing has certain elements, often a combination. Same thing with our body. You can feel the sense of the bones being the earth element. You can feel the sense of warmth in the body as the fire element, and also the coolness. Feel a sense of the air, space, as the wind element. And a sense of liquid, a sense of fluids, you know, the sense of squishiness being the liquid aspect. Now if we start to connect with our body in that way, actually you can do this as a meditative practice. Scan the body for its earth elements, the solid elements, the hard aspects, and let your attention rest there. And then switch to the quality of being warm or cool. The quality of things flowing, the liquid element. The sense of hollowness, of space, the wind element. As you start to rest in those, it's harder to land on a sense of identity. Okay, you know, how can you find that sense of flow? Okay, where are you located in that? In that sense of solidity of the bones, you know, where is the sense of you in that? And it becomes more obvious when we add that self-referentiating quality. You start to trying to land with a quality of ownership like that, or that sense of flow through my body, that's really me, or that sense of space is really me. It doesn't quite fit in the same way. You know, we don't have such an identity around that. And then finally, the Buddha pulls out all the stops, just in case you still haven't got the point. You know, it's like He says, okay, look at the body, you know, this is a sense process of movement. You know, let go of the sense of identification. Look at the body as different parts. Look at the body as elements. He says, okay, now if you still don't quite get this, if there's still some holding on, go to the charnel ground. Go to the place where the dead bodies are. So again, back in India, in the time of the Buddha, and still some places today, there's, you know, bodies are left out, you know, to decay more naturally. And so you can actually see this. I was teaching at IMS this summer, and there's this loop, for those who've been there, the 3-mile loop. And I would go around, and I saw this dead possum. And the first day I saw the raw body, and the next day, you know, it had been picked a bit, so it was starting to become more and more skeletalized, and the heat had worked on it, and the insects. And so over these course of days, I saw the body naturally decaying and being, you know, eventually the skeleton was spread out. And so the Buddha recommended looking at a body in this way and reflecting how, okay, here at one point it was whole. It was this sense of self, a sense of who I was. And the sense of me is also subject to that. You know, looking at a body who's one day old, dead, one day dead, 2 days dead, etc. That this body too, this body of mine, is also, this is its nature. This is its, such is its future, such is its unavoidable fate. Okay? So this is very strong medicine. But when you start to reflect on that way, that this body that we take so personally, that we cherish, also is subject to death, to decay. And the Buddha goes through the process of decay and looking at it in, I think, around 7 different stages. You start to see it being picked by the, you know, the animals, and starting to become more of just a skeleton. We start to see the bones be detached and spread this way and that way. Bones detached from their tendons, scattered in all directions. Here a hand bone, there a foot bone, here a shin bone, there a thigh bone, here a hip bone, there a back bone, here a rib, there a breast bone, here a shoulder bone, there a neck bone, here a jaw bone, there a tooth, here a skull. So you can imagine looking at a skeleton that's just been kind of spread apart, and you say, okay, that too is my body, has that potential. And you start to hold your body in a little different way. You start to loosen the identification around the body. Looking at the bones whitened, piled up more than a year old, and finally decomposed into a powder. You know, the practitioner applies this to their very own body. This body too, such is its nature, such is its future, such is its unavoidable fate. Now this practice isn't meant to make us depressed or make us, you know, obsessed with death, but just to bring actually, by paradox, more of a vitality of living. To realize this body I take as being whole is just a set of conditions. It just come together and it's here for a while, but it's not who I am. And this question, who am I? If I'm not my body, if I'm not my identification with my body, who am I? Where am I located? And as in all the Buddhist teachings, the invitation is to see for yourself, to not take my word for it, not to take the Buddha's word for it, but actually start to look at the body in this way and see if it starts to naturally become a little deconstructed. The deconstruction at first is a little disorienting. But once you go through that, you start to see again there's a deep peace beyond that. You see how the identification is the same as our suffering. Again, you still have the capacity to know how to vote and how to go and do your job and how to do all those things. But that's not the end of the story. There's this other quality that keeps growing and developing, the sense of deep interconnection, a sense of unity. And then as we go through this sutta over this month, we'll look at other places we take as being us. Okay, we'll explore the body, really spend some time exploring that, seeing how the body is mine, me, and seeing how true that is. And then we'll go into the mind, we'll go into the reactivity, into thoughts. Maybe that's where we are. We'll explore and find out. All right, so let's just sit quietly for a moment or two and let those words settle. As we sit, the sense of body, just let that come to the forefront. This is my body. And then letting the attention, the awareness go below the idea of body into what the actual sensations are. It's this simple. And how the sensations, if you just rest with that, you don't have to form an identity around that. It's simply about rejoining this natural flow of life. All right, thank you for your attention. I'll just say a few words about the practice and reflection for this week before we open up to any dialogue or questions, comments that might be out there. So reflecting on how you identify as your body. Okay? This is my hand. This is my foot. The parts, I like this aspect. I don't like this aspect. Just start to reflect on the body and how you know it's yours. How do you know this is your body and all the memories and history around that? And then after you kind of get a sense of that identification, this is who I am, this is my body, this is mine, my surgeries, all those things. Start to notice what happens to the concept of body the idea of my body as you go into the actual sensations, the actual experience of bodiness, especially as you sustain that attention in the actual sensations. And notice, is it harder to maintain the idea of I am my body at the level of sensations? Right? Simply said, but see if it's true. See if it's true. You know, and next week you can let me know if it's true or not. And if you're not your body, then what are you? Where are you located? See if you can find that sense of where am I? And then for extra credit, read some of the Satipatthana Sutta, especially the body section. That's the first section. Right? So I would, you know, read it a few times. Read it, and at first you'd be like, what's he talking about? And but kind of let yourself kind of it takes a little while to get the knack of reading the suttas, and it takes a little bit of patience. And a good place to find this is Access to Insight, which is a good free online source. So you can type in Satipatthana Sutta or MN10. That's the number of the sutta. All right, so how can I help clarify that topic? Yes.
And what experience in your own body you were, you know, when you're looking at, you know, parts of your body, what was happening?
Yeah. So comment or question is around watching that possum decay, and what was my experience of doing that? So, you know, first, you know, you're seeing something dead. There's that sense of you know, repulsion and that sense of sadness and grief. You know, there's the whole emotional aspect that arises with that. Then in this part of the sutta, the Buddha doesn't really go into that. You know, later on in the sutta, you know, brings forth the reactivity and emotionality, the mental states. So that was the first impulse. It's like, wow, there's this creature had died. You know, and so feeling that gripping, and then reflecting, okay, that too is my body's subject to that. You know, and so as I did that, there's often a little bit, you feel that kind of gripping of that gripping of wanting to that not to be true. Maybe I'm the one person who's that's not the case. You know, so there's all the stages of grief, of denial, like, oh, that can't be, or, you know, I should do something with that. So you have to kind of let that kind of the body, the mind do that kind of a thing. And then, you know, you still kind of stay connected. Just like feeling your breath. Feeling the breath and the body, mind is all this distractions, but you just keep coming back. That essential training then you bring to something like seeing a possum decaying. You know, and so that's the reason we do it. It's not because this is a breath meditation. It's just a nice, convenient way to learn some basic skills, some essential skills of how to relate to the moment's experience. And so then, you know, each day I would go back, and one day I actually saw a vulture, you know, waiting for me to leave, and just watching the body get more, less of a body, less recognizable. You know, and then it's like, okay, so this body I take as being so solid, given the right conditions, given my death, it will start to have the same effects. And so then then working in that way, you start to have a sense of inner stillness that comes from that. Once you kind of go through the fear around the repulsion of seeing another creature that's died, the sadness around that, to start to see, okay, if I'm not my body, then where can I really, I start to learn where the true home is, where's the trustworthy place of residing. Yeah, so it was just like from the sutta. What else is out there? Yes. Yes. So the question is, what's been helpful to go from that place of observation, like observing the breath, to that place of just awareness? And how do you kind of make that bridge, or how do you work with that? So it's, you know, working with Rodney, that was kind of, you know, it's of course for those who've studied with him, that's a big emphasis in his teaching. And I just, you know, kind of got very interested in that very topic. And so that sense of interest, that sense of curiosity, provides the energy for the inquiry, for the mindfulness. So the mindfulness and inquiry, they're kind of very related, but also a little different. I think of mindfulness as this capacity to see what's present without flinching, without trying to judge it or alter it or change it, but just to see it so clearly. And then there's also this component of befriending it. Is a sense of, okay, of interest, of engagement. Now, inquiry takes that same quality and directs it. Okay, so look here, look there. Okay, so I might be looking at a point of reactivity, I might be looking at a sense of identification, looking at my reaction to seeing a dead possum decaying. And it can also look at that sense of me observing. Okay, so I start to say, okay, I see maybe watching my breath. And where is that sense of me watching it? Where is that located? Can I sense that? Can I get a taste of that? And so then to do that, you have to be willing to back up a little bit, become a little bit quieter. Because you become a little quieter, you get the sense of you watching. You know, for me, it often feels like a little bit of attention, a little bit of distance. But then it's like, okay, if I'm watching the watcher, what's watching that? And so then I have to get a little bit more quiet and more quiet. And so each time you get a little softer, a little bit more still. You know, so often the mindfulness has to be, you know, sometimes in the right stability, you know, maybe cultivated through a retreat environment, but also just the very interest of it can be enough even in daily life to notice how that sense of meanness is showing up. Right? And so when you get a sense of that, you start to see how the sense of me is not only the observer, the watcher, but also this impulses to control, to judge, to be a certain way, to guard, to, you know, it's almost like the, I want to say like the charge, when there's a charge, like a static, a charge in something, that's like the self, there's a friction with something, that's when the self is there. So you become like a detective. You start to notice the more and more subtle qualities. And then you start to get to a point where you realize any sense of me trying to look, me trying to do, to see, is just a more subtle quality of that sense of observation. And then, okay, what's left is a sense of surrender. A sense of that I have to, instead of observe the stillness, actually enter into the stillness. I have to be willing to release the sense of positionality, of security, of orientation, you know, to fall into that stillness. And if, you know, if the conditions are right, if there's a sense of stability that's still there, it's not it doesn't cause a sense of unrest, it's more of a sense of really falling into that deep stillness. Does that help? Yeah, so do I mean not identifying with the stillness?
If you're identifying, yeah. You're attaching to it, right?
Yes, exactly.
So you're trying to kind of experience the stillness without kind of hold on to it.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So the trying to identify, look at the stillness without trying to hold on to it, without identifying with it. And you can often notice this when the stillness isn't present. And there's a sense, oh, I want to get back there. I want to get back to that state. Okay, that's the mechanism. It's like we kind of follow like a state of grace, you fall into it. And then, you know, there's last however it lasts. But then sometimes it becomes much harder to get there because of that identification. Right? And then you start to look at that identification, that sense of preferencing. It's very slippery, it's very subtle how it goes. But you know, the sutta really points to a nice way of trying to open to it. Just, you know, feel it very concretely, how the body, when you close your eyes and meditate, the body's not so distinct. And what's not distinct is a sense of me in my body. And how there's a different level of peace, of ease that comes from relating to your experience in that way. There's a sense of fluidity that comes. And when you get hardened around it, when it's like, oh wow, that you have chronic pain and your back hurts, and what that means about the future, there's a lot of suffering. Be able to feel the pain without the added on piece, it still hurts, but it's not the added on suffering. So you have to, you know, there's a sense of being able to be very subtle, but also be able to meet the very more of concrete ways the self operates. Both are very helpful in practice. Because your daily life is going to show you the places where you're not, you're still convinced of identification. That's really the gift of interpersonal conflict. Anyone else? Yes, Joyce.
So do you go in and out of this sense during the day? I mean, not always present, go back and forth.
So the comment or the question is, do you kind of go in and out of it, or is it always present? You know, I think, you know, from my own experience, there's a sense of, you know, it's present, and then I can maybe get triggered, I get, you know, forgetful, I get caught in wanting something, but it becomes less and less enticing, less convincing. And so it often takes something really major to really lock me into it, so I don't have any choice other than just, you know, trying to work my way through that. And again, those are really helpful times to see the deep level of identification. But then there's much more a sense of internal quiet. There's less of that internal chatter. The self-talk becomes quieter and quieter. And then there's this, because the mind just starts to prefer that, actually. The heart prefers that. Because it starts to realize that this allows you to be much more connected to life and spontaneously arise to what's there instead of our agenda. And, you know, as that practice, as that deepens, you know, the ratio starts to shift more and more. Yeah, so I would definitely be lying to say that it was all the time. But it's certainly as I look at the trajectory of my practice, it's much more present than it used to be. And I think, you know, sometimes we discount that sense of stillness that's actually present a lot, because it doesn't catch our interest. It doesn't make us reactive. There's maybe times we just don't pay so much attention because we're just not so engaged. Ajahn Buddhadasa talked about everyday nibbana and these moments of quenching, of quieting that are actually much more prevalent than we think. You know, we tend to focus on the crises or the wants and the not wants. But you know, if we allow it to start to orient, actually starts to grow more and more. And we start to shift from where do we identify? I identify more in that sense of reactivity or identify more in that quality of stillness. So the sense of self starts to become not this localized, contracted thing, it's more the sense of deep spaciousness. Yeah. What else is out there? Yes.
Well, I was just thinking that a lot of us who came here tonight are choosing stillness as opposed to reactivity. That we came here because we acknowledge, you know, I would rather be still than reactive.
Yes.
I was just thinking that when you talked about the Vidasa, that, you know, we are discerning and making that choice, and so we had some of that.
Yes, so the comment was, you know, choosing to be here, you know, there's a sense of voting with our feet, you know, valuing the stillness over the noise. You're particularly talking about the election stuff.
Yes.
And I keep having to teach. I taught on election night, the presidential election, and inauguration night, and now. But yeah, it's true. It's like we start to value that more and more. I mean, we so much focus on what's not right in our worlds, you know, what's broken, what's dangerous, what we have to fix, and we kind of gloss over the parts which are working well. I think it can be really helpful to bring attention to that. Like, you know, I made a choice to be still, you know, to start to notice those choices that you make. What you bring attention to starts to grow more and more. And I think that's one of the big turning parts in our lives as meditators, is we start to learn to not put our attention on what causes suffering, what causes reactivity. That's usually what we put our focus on, and we just get more and more amped up around it. When we start to become a little disillusioned with that, we become not so enamored with that, and we start to be drawn toward a different quality, and then that starts to grow. And so then the feedback loop starts to grow in that way, in more stillness, more clarity, more compassion. All right, any last questions or comments? Yes. Yes.
I try to think of strategies, try to use that as a teaching tool to not get into that. But I don't know, I was just wondering what thoughts you had around that sense that the body is almost faster than the conscious brain of. We're crossing our arms, or our shoulders are up, or our eyebrows are up.
Yeah. So the observation and question is around how the body is kind of almost a truer read about what's really happening, and how, you know, the body may be reacting without us really consciously knowing, and it kind of leads the show, and then the mind catches up, the awareness, and how it's you know, how do you work with that? How does that work? And I think that's, yeah, absolutely true, is that the body is a much, you know, gives you a different level of information. And I often think, you know, as I look at my own history and I look at beginning students, how there's such a identification with the world of thought and idea, and then learning how to connect with the body, it opens up this whole other realm of information. And so I think the sense of pause is so helpful, because the pause allows you to just connect and see what's present in the body. Not what you think should be there, or what you think, you know, ought to be there, but what's kind of the echoes in the body, what's the sense of the body doing. And it's really helpful to just have that steadiness of attention. You know, one teacher described it as, when you're going through life, just keep about 20% of your awareness in your body when you're talking, when you're doing something. And that much is really helpful. Like there's this... the body language, you know, the old, you know, speak no evil, see no evil, hear no evil. So those things I was reading about body language, and often people will, you know, do something. There's like a little tell. They're feeling not so much deceitful, but just uncomfortable about saying something. And as I read that, I noticed that, I start to say something and I, my hand's coming up. It's like Dr. Strangelove. It's like, but it's like noticing that, being mindful of what the body's doing. It's like, oh, and then I start to, okay, let's look at the whole system. Let's see what the mind's doing, the heart's doing. And I think it's very helpful to do that. And often when you're not quite sure about what to do and how to say something, just checking with the body and say, okay, option A, and the body goes, option B, the body goes, okay, and that's often a good guide. I think it's very helpful. I think it's one of the great benefits of becoming more and more embodied and more grounded in this body, this sense of somatic experience, of seeing what the body's actually, what's its life, what's its experience. Yeah, I think it's much more honest than the mind often is willing to be. All right, so let's end that. I have a couple announcements. So again, thank you for your engaged questions.